Okay, good morning. It is Monday morning, 10:20, on, I don't know, June 22nd. And we're jumping into Chem 3 for the lecture. And some updates, some things. Let's see, what do I got to tell you? For those of you who weren't in the morning lab session, I've got a new lab assignment that is up and ready for you guys to go. We'll talk about that in the afternoon. I don't want you to do it just yet. We'll kind of do it together in the afternoon. I have a plan for us to do a little bit more of the dimensional analysis in the first hour, and then in the second hour, getting people into doing that lab assignment. We are now past the add date for the class. So anybody who's trying to still add, and I was still trying to coordinate with a couple people, I don't know why, but I was having difficulty over email coordinating with people who needed certain things. If you need to still add the class, you wanted to add the lab, or you didn't get added into the lecture for some reason, we need to do it by a late add process. I need to initiate it and do the paperwork, but you need to communicate with me and let me know that you're still having trouble trying to get into the class or getting into the lab. And then I will initiate that late add paperwork and we will get that in place and get that going for you. And we will get that fixed. So those are the two announcements that I have. Other announcements are, I sent out an email that I have gone through your quizzes and I have gone through your assignments and I have awarded points back for many of the problems, particularly the last problem on the quiz. I don't like the way that it's structured, that there's 6 points on that quiz on that last problem. And if you get a sig fig wrong or you get a rounding error, it takes all 6 points away. Or if you didn't write the units right, it takes all 6 points away. It's very literal in the way that it looks at answers. It looks at them as just text strings. So I don't like to grade that way. I like to grade with a lot of partial credit. And for sig figs, I traditionally just take a point off. So even if it's a 20-point problem and you get a sig fig wrong, you still get 19 points out of those 20 points, just 1 point for sig fig. But there's no way that I can program that into Canvas, so I have to go back and grade that all manually anyway. If you took the quiz late, for instance, some people were still taking that quiz this morning, it still counts. It doesn't take any points off, but I haven't had a chance to assess your quiz to go back and do that individually. And part of that is a tracking issue. I don't know exactly how to track who took it after I've already gone back and assessed it last weekend. So that's why I try to put the deadlines on there, is I like to try to get you guys to take those things or take those assignments by the deadline so that we're all on the same thing. So when I go in and assess it, to give points back and make sure that everything looks okay, that I capture everybody. I don't want to miss anybody. So if you took it late, like you took it today, you may want to email me and let me know, hey, I just took that quiz and could you please reassess mine or just look at it and make sure that everything looks okay. And that way I can track and make sure that I've done that. But the last time that I went through it was last night. So last night at like around, I don't know, I think it was 6 in the evening, not that late. That was the last time that I went through it and looked at everybody's to make sure that I captured everybody. Okay, so those are my big announcements. Other than that, I think it's time to open up for questions and ask if there's any questions. And if not, then I'm going to jump in to where we left off in lecture, which is in chapter 2 with early atomic theory.
I do kind of have just like a general question about how participation and attendance works. Like I read the little announcement about how attendance is just like participating in the classwork. Yeah. But do we get like a grade for participating in the class, like lecture time, like asking questions and stuff, or is it just?
In general, no. In general, what I would say is that I generally don't take attendance and I don't have points that I award for attendance. However, it is always a good thing. I mean, this is a very large class. I mean, we've got 80 some odd students that are in the class. And right now there's only 44 that are in lecture. But it can only help you by participating in lecture and by also asking questions and a little bit of FaceTime with me that I recognize you. That's always just a good thing. I'm rooting for everybody, to be honest with you. I want everybody to succeed and I want everybody to meet their goals. But by having a little bit of FaceTime and I just became even just a bigger cheerleader to get you where you want to be. So I don't have any specific points that I put on that. But yeah, I think that it doesn't do anything but help.
Awesome. Okay? Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else before I jump in and start with lecture? Okay, maybe not. I am going to just take 1 second here and make my image on the computer just a little bit cleaner. I've got a back, that's a little bit better. I've got a window in my office that throws a lot of backlighting, and the camera can't handle the backlighting. So even though we're on a screen share and there's that little image of me, I'd like that little image to be just a little bit cleaner. All right. Let's jump into the early atomic theory. We already did Dalton's theory. We did the law of multiple proportions, and we talked about that last time. And that took us into the evolution of atomic theory 2.2. And I want to remind you guys that as we start looking at some of this history component, that my emphasis, my emphasis is always on the practical skills and not so much memorization of the history. So while I'm going over some of these things, and they're important in terms of our concept and understanding of how this information has evolved and how it was learned over time, I'm not going to ask you questions about dates. I'm not going to ask you questions about people. I'm not going to ask you questions necessarily about experiments that were done that showed a certain thing. I'm more interested in the practical skills, but I do want to get through some of this information. And this is the more interesting component, the more interesting story of how some of this evolved to be. And I think that that's important as well. Okay, so Emily shot me a question. In Canvas under grades, show there's an assignment labeled assignment week one copy. Okay, Emily, that's a great question. And in the Canvas shell, under the syllabus, there is a thing that says assignment week one copy in the syllabus. And I need to figure out how to delete that sucker and get it out of there. I can't figure out how that's propagating through. It was that I was copying Canvas pages and duplicating them when I created new ones. And somehow they propagate into the syllabus page that looks like there are assignments that are not being completed by you. But when you look in the module, you won't see them listed in the module because they've been deleted already. I don't know how to get them out of that part of the Canvas shell. And so I need to consult some Canvas gurus on campus and have them tell me how I can delete some of those pieces. So you're not missing anything. It's an error and it needs to be deleted, and I'll need to figure out how to do that. And then Megan, you've got a quick question.
Yeah, just real quick, if you don't mind, I had a question about dimensional analysis on one of the problems you did on Thursday. If you want, maybe I'll just jump in on office hour and ask you, actually.
That might be better. Yeah, that might be the better place. Or Megan, are you going to be in the afternoon lab?
Yeah,
because we could also deal with it there in the afternoon lab. And that would be a good place to deal with it. Yeah, so hang on to that question. Don't lose it. And we'll do it there. We'll make sure that we did it.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. And Emily, okay, so you're not missing anything, Emily, and we dealt with that question and we're all set there. All right, for some reason, I am not screen sharing. And interesting. Okay. Screen sharing now? Everybody can see it? We're on track. Looks like we're good. Okay. All right, so where we left off was we left off with that law of multiple proportions. And what the law of multiple proportions told us, just sort of backtracking just a little bit, and this was Dalton who had discovered this, was that Dalton found that when he took compounds that had the same two elements in it, but in different proportions, that he could divide those masses by one another, and the division of those masses always resulted in a whole number. Small whole numbers. And that we said that those small whole numbers, what they told us when we were looking at Dalton and the law of multiple proportions. Is that things like copper plus chlorine resulted in two possibilities where we had copper mixing with one chlorine and copper mixing with two chlorines. And so we would get a 1-to-1 ratio and a 1-to-2 ratio, and that these were always small whole numbers. And that law of multiple proportions is what it's telling us is that atoms are indivisible, that atoms come in small whole number ratios or combine in small whole number ratios. And that was an important aspect of looking at atomic theory, was this ability that atoms were indivisible and that this was the smallest component of matter that we could really have. And that was the experiment that was telling us that was that law of multiple proportions. Okay, moving on, we move into chapter 2.2.
Can I just ask a quick question about that?
Yeah.
So when I was reading the textbook and they had that compound example with the copper and chlorine.
Yeah.
They in the example, they took the ratio of the two ratios, but when they explained that, they said that it was a 2-to-1 ratio for only the brown compound. So I guess I'm not really understanding what they're trying to show there.
Okay, good question. That is not it. Hang on, and I will find it. Actually, that should have been it, because that was our last lecture. Yes. Okay, so here's where we dealt with that.
Yeah.
Where we did the law of multiple proportions. And what they said was that they start with 1 gram of copper in each case. Mm-hmm. And they find that 1 gram of copper mixes with 1.116 grams of chlorine and it makes a brown solid. And 1 gram of copper can also mix with 0.558 grams of chlorine to make a green solid. And that if you take those ratios, the 1.116 and divide it by the 0.558, you get this 2-to-1 ratio, which means that there is twice as much chlorine in the top compound as in the bottom. So it's not really telling you the ratio of chlorine to copper. It's just telling you that there is twice as much chlorine in the brown compound as there is in the chlorine. And that's telling us that those ratios are consistent, that no matter if I change from 1 gram and do 2 grams of copper and then do this experiment again, I'll still get this 2-to-1 ratio. It's telling us that the atoms are combining in whole number ratios. And that 2-to-1, you can kind of see how I've mapped it out, blue to pink kind of color. And that's just telling us the ratios of the chlorines in these different compounds. That experiment, that's what they're trying to get at in the law of multiple proportions, is that when it is small, what we say binary meaning two things, small binary compounds will always give these small whole number ratios when this experiment is done. And it is telling that we don't get fractions, that we don't get 1.17, 1.8, 1. Whatever, that we get these whole numbers. And the whole numbers are telling us that atoms can only come in whole numbers. That's what this experiment is really getting at. So it's not telling us necessarily about the copper, but it's telling us about the ratios of chlorine and that this was the only way to get at this piece of information at that time. And that no matter when they did this experiment, they always got whole numbers. And when you do an experiment and something that is so tiny that can't be seen, that can't be understood, that when you do this experiment and you always get a whole number, what it implies is that small unit is indivisible and that small unit can only come in whole numbers. And that was not something that was known to be. That was a new discovery, because it seemed that no matter how small we cut matter down, we could always keep cutting it into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces. And the question was, well, how long can that go on for? Can it go on indefinitely? Is matter made up of something that can just be infinitely divisible? And the answer was, when they did this experiment, the answer was no. that there was a point where it became indivisible and that it only showed up in whole number ratios. And I'm spending so much time on that right now because it's an extremely important concept as we move forward within chemistry, that atoms are indivisible and that they come in whole number ratios. And that when we start to look at compounds and molecules, that they will always be in finite ratios and that those ratios will always be whole number ratios. Okay. So that's an important concept moving forward. Does that help a little bit?
Kind of. I think I probably just need to spend more time with it and I will understand it.
What I'll say about it, Kerrigan, is that you don't have to necessarily understand the entire experiment. That the experiment and how it exactly implies what I'm saying it implies is not necessarily is not necessary to move forward. That it's enough to move forward to recognize that these are whole numbers, and that these whole numbers are telling me that I get whole number ratios, and that if you just accept that we get whole number ratios, then you're okay moving forward.
So I guess my last question then would be, maybe this will help me, what do those whole numbers, what are they representing?
They're representing that if I take and I look at ratios of atoms together, for instance, water comes with two hydrogens and one oxygen. Yeah. And that if I change that ratio, it's not water anymore.
Yes.
It's something different. It's something new. For instance, this one is water, but H2O2 in these ratios is hydrogen peroxide. And it has completely different properties and reacts completely differently. And so these compounds will be in whole number ratios all the time. You'll never get H 3.6 or 2.7. You can't get fractions.
Okay.
Always have to come in whole number ratios.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Now I understand what this is trying to represent.
Okay. Cool. And that was perfect because you forced me. That was perfect. You forced me to find an example that actually made it hit home. And that's the goal. That's what we try to do. And that's why I keep talking until I hear that, I see that light bulb go on. That's what we're struggling for. That's what we're fighting for here, is to get that light bulb to go on. So thank you for pushing me to do that.
Thank you.
Megan.
You kind of just answered it, so I think I'm good.
Okay. Awesome. All right. So that was our law of definite proportions. And that's what was coming out of that. So now what we're going to do is, come on, I'm trying to grab this and move this down and move this back up because that goes with that piece. And now we can jump into chapter two. And in chapter two, we're going to go through a few more experiments that talk about the evolution of atomic theory, our way of thinking about how atoms are constructed and what it really means. So in the 1890s, J.J. Thompson did an experiment. And I think the time frame is kind of interesting here. That how long ago this was. And what J.J. Thompson did is he was looking at these particles that were called electrons, and he used an experiment called a cathode ray tube. And what the cathode ray tube does is it's a pretty cool device. It has an anode. So this piece here is the anode, and it has basically positive charge on it. And then it has a cathode, and this has a negative charge on it. And this cathode and this anode are plugged in a way so that this thing goes through an electrical circuit. And this whole thing is included in a sealed glass tube. And at the end of the tube, there is a piece out here that is metal, and it has a coating on it, and it's a fluorescent coating. I'm not spelling it right, but CNT fluorescent. And what happens is these particles get created and fired towards the anode. They come through, and then when they strike this, we get a glowing color. And that color depends on what the fluorescent material is made out of, so that it can glow different colors. And these particles, they called electrons. And the experiment that he really did is he took and used a magnet and was able to locate a magnet with the negative end and the positive end of the bar magnet. And he was able to cause the electrons to deflect. And so the magnet, as he moved the negative end, it would cause the electrons to deflect away. And when they did this experiment and they put the positive end, so what we would see is that the electron flow would deviate away from a magnet that had its negative end that way. And if I put the positive end of the magnet towards it, the electrons would deviate towards the magnet. And so they could change the flow of the electrons. And so what J.J. Thompson decided out of this experiment, the outcome of this experiment is that electrons were negatively charged particles. And the reason that he decided that is because like charges repel. So if I have two negative charges, the two negative charges will repel one another. And yet a negative charge and a positive charge are attracted. And so electrons were negatively charged, and they gave them the symbol of an E and a upper-scripted or a superscripted negative charge. And this cathode ray tube was the foundation for all televisions, that the original television design worked on a cathode ray tube. So while you were sitting there staring at a television, what was going on behind the television was a cathode ray tube was aimed at you, at the screen, inside the television. And the cathode ray tube would have a series of magnets that would move, and the magnets would direct the electrons to hit the screen where there was phosphorus, and the phosphorus would light up the different colors. And so you would have red, green, and blue that would light up as this cathode ray tube scanned across the television screen, and the electrons would hit the phosphorus, make the different colors, which would make the image that would then represent on the television. So now we don't have televisions like that very much anymore. I think you can still maybe find them, but most of them are all flat screens that work on a very different sort of technology. But all the original television screens, all of the original CRT television screens, cathode ray tube, that's what the CRT stood for. And they were all based on J.J. Thompson's design from the 1890s that they made an image, a screen out of, essentially. So that's the cathode ray tube experiment, and that gave us the charge on an electron. It told us what the charge was on an electron, on this subatomic particle. So we now know that electrons are negatively charged. In 1909, Robert Mulliken did an experiment also with electrons. So 1909, we're looking at Robert Mulliken now. And his experiment was a very famous experiment called the oil drop experiment. And it's referred to as Mulliken's oil drop experiment. And what Mulliken was doing was, and this is a harder experiment to draw, but essentially what he had was a chamber. And inside this chamber, it had a funnel type thing up here that oil drops would pass through. And those oil drops, as they passed through, there was a plate inside this thing with a little hole in it. And this is the harder part to draw. And the plate with the hole in it inside here, this plate was charged positively. Positive charge plate. And down at the bottom, he had a negatively charged plate. And what he would do, as these oil drops fell, there was a device out here that would generate x-rays. And the x-rays would hit the drops. And as the x-rays hit the drops, what the x-rays do is they knock off electrons off the drop. And the drops would fall at a rate based on gravity. But what he found is that by changing the negatively charged plate, he could actually cause the drops to fall slower, and in some cases, almost entirely stop. And what that was doing, by slowing down these oil drops, he was able to measure the actual charge on the drop based on how slow he could cause the drop to go. So what he was measuring the charge on a drop and what he found was that they were always a factor of, let's see what it was, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th and this was a coulomb, C-O-U-L-M-B coulomb. I don't know if I'm spelling that right, I gotta check that. But the coulomb is a measurement of charge, and because these droplets always had some factor, 1, 2, 3, 4 times this 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th coulombs. What he reasoned was the charge on an electron, that an electron charge equals 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th coulombs, and that that is the charge on an electron itself. And through a process, he was also able to determine the size of the electron, the mass. I should really not say size, but mass of an electron. And that the mass of the electron was 9.107 times 10 to the minus 31st kilograms. An incredibly small amount of mass on an electron. But so he was able to actually figure out the charge on an electron and the size of the electron by this oil drop experiment, by knocking electrons off of the oil drop, thereby incurring charge on the oil drop and slowing it down by passing it over a plate that would actually cause a repulsive nature to that electron. So that's kind of cool. Eric, could we go over the table on page 75 of the textbook? Seems like things may line up. The table in the textbook, I think maybe I can get to it. Let me see what I can do. So that is at OpenStax. There we go. Subjects, science, 2E. Did I go to the right one? Shapoopy. Adams first. I did not go to the right one. And then table of contents, early evolution. And there it is. So, yes, this is the image. And I think, Eric, this is the table that you're asking about. And we're on page 70. It doesn't have page numbers for me, But I think that's the table that you're asking about. What these are these are the charges on separate oil drops. And that if you look at these charges, they are all multiples of 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th. That one of them is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th. One of them is 3 times 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th. And that, again, we're getting whole number ratios, 1, 2, 3, in terms of these charges and how these charges were stripped off the oil drop. And because they were coming in whole number ratios, they're telling us that electrons are another form of indivisible matter, that electrons are not fractional, that electrons are these particle-like things that come in whole numbers. And we were able to determine the size of them by mass and the charge on them in terms of the Coulombic charge on the electron as well. So that's another important aspect of that, of what Thomson contributed. And so an electron was known not to be an isolatable form of matter. In other words, we had the elements, and the elements were the smallest form of matter. Electrons are something else. Electrons are something that contribute to making an atom and contribute to making matter, but they are a subatomic form. They are something that are inside the atoms. And we have now figured out that they are a negative charged particle that are inside them. And we've figured out their size. So that's what Thomson was contributing by that oil drop experiment. And it's important because it was the first time that the charge on an electron was actually measured. And so that's where that's coming from. That's where that experiment, or what that experiment leads to. And then we have Rutherford. And Rutherford did another really cool experiment. And Eric, yeah, energy not matter. It's a close run thing there, that when we look at an electron, that because the electron had mass, we don't think of the electron as energy. We think of the electron as a particle. Although we will get into let me scroll back up. Oh, there it is. 9.107 times 10 to the minus 34th kilograms was the mass of the electron. We will get into the dual nature of electrons, that electrons behave like waves, but then they also have nature of particles. And so we'll need to talk about this dual nature of electrons and how electrons behave. And it's a really interesting concept of how electrons behave, whether they have both particles. They have both natures, the nature of a particle and the nature of a wave, but we can't always talk about them at the same time. We either talk about the wave-like particles, or we talk about the, I don't know why I'm having so much difficulty speaking here. We either talk about the wave-like behavior of the electron, or we talk about the particle-like behavior of the electron, but we don't generally talk about both at the same time. They are different sort of ideas of how the electron behaves. And it behaves in two different ways. Okay, so moving on from the electron, what Rutherford did was a really cool experiment. Rutherford took a piece of gold foil, very, very thin gold foil.
What year was this, Jason?
For Rutherford? Yes. Rutherford was around the same time. Rutherford is in the early 1900s. I don't have a year.
Okay.
But this, so this is, early 1900s. And what Rutherford did with this gold foil is he took and he fired at it radiation, and a specific type of radiation. So he had a machine over here that produced an alpha particle. And an alpha particle – is one of the weakest forms of radiation that we know of. So there are alpha, there is beta, and there is gamma, and they go in increasing amounts of energy. So this is the smallest type of energy radiation that we can produce. And an alpha particle actually is sort of a helium with a 2+ charge on it, with no electrons. It's just the nucleus of a helium atom, and it's what we call an alpha particle. And what that alpha particle did is he had a circular detector around this foil, and he found that most of the radiation, most of the alpha particles would hit directly behind the target. In other words, the alpha particles passed through the gold foil as if there was nothing there. And yet, a few of these particles would ricochet and hit in different places. So we would get a few hits out here and a few hits over here. And every once in a while, one would ricochet back 180 degrees and come right back at the source. And so we would get a few hits that would come directly back from the foil. And the takeaways from this were, number one, that the volume of a solid is mostly empty. That as much as we think of a solid as being a solid and impermeable, that the majority of a solid is empty space. Is that what that was his conclusion. Number two, that because the alpha particle is a positively charged particle, and we knew this, that alpha is got a 2+ charge on it, that it's positively charged. Because the alpha particle is positively charged, there must be small positively charged particles inside the solid. Why are we saying that? Well, because if we think about the solid, if this is the solid, and there are these positively charged nucleuses that are inside the solid, thinking about it this way, that the alpha particle, if it comes this way, the alpha particle just passes through. But if an alpha particle comes this way, it will get close to that positive charge, and then it will deflect off of it, because like charges repel one another. And so because the like charges repel one another, that accounts for these deviations of why the alpha particle was deviating and changing its course as it passed through that very, very thin tissue paper size gold foil. And so it was telling us that there is empty space in between these particles, and that these particles were positively charged, and that the alpha particle would deflect when it got close to them, and that once in a while, that alpha particle would hit and collide, and so the alpha particle would come in, it would hit directly, and bounce directly back off. So our alpha particle would come in, and our alpha particle would come right back off and bounce right back off it. And what he said was that these alpha particles were so energetic that, and this foil so thin, that it was akin to firing a 15-inch shell at tissue paper and having that 15-inch shell fire right back at you. Just turn around and come right back at you, not even going through the tissue paper. And so this was an exciting outcome for Rutherford, to be able to say that solids had empty space in them, and that there was something that was positively charged and very tiny, but also very dense, such that alpha particle would bounce back off it. And Eric, I see the word magnetic. And magnetic is an interesting word. When we say magnetic, we think about the like charges on a magnet as being the negative end and the positive end, and that the negative ends of magnets will repel one another, and so we get a repulsive force. And that when we take like ends of a magnet and put them together, opposite ends, that they will attract one another and we get an attractive force. The forces that we are looking at as charges are like those of a magnet, but they are not identical to a magnet. So magnetism and the attraction and repulsive forces that result in magnetism are a little bit different than the forces that we're looking at of these attractive and repulsive forces with these fundamental charges of protons and electrons. There we call them Coulombic attraction and Coulombic repulsion in these charges. And it's coming from a different force than the magnetism itself. Very similar. And we will use magnetism as a model to understand these other Coulombic attractions and repulsions, but they're fundamentally a little bit different. So thanks for using that term. Okay, and so then in 1921, Frederick Soddy did some other experiments. So what we've got out of this so far is that out of Dalton, we've got this idea of indivisibility of atoms. So Dalton gave us indivisibility of atoms, that atoms are sort of the smallest pieces of matter. And then along with that, we've got Thompson, who is giving us the indivisibility of electrons, also the charge on an electron, and the mass of the electron. So Thompson gave us all of those. And then Mulliken is giving us the fact that that matter has mostly empty space. And also that there are small, dense, positive charges. At the center of matter. And we'll say of atoms, actually, that at the center of atoms that there are these small positively charged, actually that wasn't Mulliken, that was Rutherford. So yeah, we'll get Rutherford back in there. So we'll slide this down and we'll give us Rutherford. I'll fix Mulliken in a second.
So when you get a second, when I was reading through this section, what my like takeaway was that it was introducing like how the like structure of an atom is defined, and like, you know, like protons and neutrons and electrons and the nucleus of the atom. But I just was wondering, could you clarify how? Like, I understand the word indivisibility, but when it's used in this context, could you explain what that means?
Yes.
And I know that's kind of repetitive, but it's helpful.
It's okay. Actually, all of this that I ascribed to Thompson goes to Mulliken. Let me fix this real quick, as I'm trying to, as I made a mess out of things. What Thompson did was found electrons had negative charges. It was really Mulliken who found that electrons were not divisible, and that the charge and the mass. And then Rutherford is giving us this concept of matter has mostly empty space, and that there are small positive charges at the center of atoms. Okay, indivisible. It goes back to this idea that we talked about before, that when I look at copper combining with chlorine, that they can combine in a 1-to-1 ratio, or they can combine in a 2-to-1 ratio, but not in copper 1.6, chlorine 3.2, that I can't get a fraction of an atom. And in the same way, I can't get the fraction of an electron, that electrons are a fundamental unit and they come in whole numbers, ones, twos, threes, fours. Okay. That's important thing.
That's that idea I was struggling with earlier. Awesome. Thank you.
Exactly. Same idea. You're struggling with the same concept there.
Surprise. Yeah.
That's okay. Okay. So now, now what we get is a series of things that are going to lead us very quickly to chapter 2.3 and the full-on atomic structure. But this last little part has two other people, Soddy and Chadwick. Soddy was...
Real quick, could you just scroll up so that we can see the changes that you made?
Oh, yes. I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
Okay, so the last couple of things. Frederick Soddy, in 1921, won the Nobel Prize for the discovery that atoms came in different flavors for a single element. For instance, for hydrogen, there are three different types of hydrogen, all hydrogen, but they weigh different, so that there is a light hydrogen, a slightly more heavy hydrogen, and an even more heavy hydrogen after that. And he gave a name to those. He called them isotopes. And isotopes are like brothers and sisters. They come from the same family, but they're slightly different in their makeup. It was a neat discovery, and awarded him the Nobel Prize to be able to figure that out. And what they originally thought was that these isotopes were individual elements in and of themselves. And after doing more work, what Soddy had discovered was that isotopes were not actually different elements. They are just different versions of the same element. And so I'm going to go ahead and scroll off this page, if I may. And we'll come down here and we'll finish out just these last little pieces that Frederick Soddy in 1921 won the Nobel Prize. For discovery of isotopes. What an isotope is, an isotope are different versions of an element. And we're going to define it more formally in a minute. As we get into chapter 2.3, we actually go through and define it. But to give you an example, there is hydrogen and three different types of hydrogen. So there is what we call a hydrogen 1, a hydrogen 2, and a hydrogen 3. And these different hydrogens, this hydrogen number 2 weighs twice hydrogen 1. And this one weighs three times as much as hydrogen 1. they're all still hydrogen, but they weigh different amounts, so they have different masses. And they are all in the same family, and they are all called isotopes. So isotope, what an isotope is a relationship. We say that an isotope, if you were to ask which one of these hydrogens is the isotope, it is the same question as lining up three siblings and saying which of them is the brother or which of them is the sister. Brother and sister are a relationship between individuals. And the same thing with isotopes. Isotopes are a relationship with between individuals. Alex, did I zoom out enough? Okay, see that. And Jeremy, you had a question. What about the A-bomb? Jeremy, we'll get to questions about the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb is a way of a chemical reaction, a nuclear reaction, that gets out of control, that goes very, very quickly. And actually, it's one of the last things that we sort of cover, is looking at radiation, the different types of radiation, what constitutes radiation, what happens when an element undergoes a radiative decay, and how quickly that can happen, and the amount of energy that's released when that happens. It's a whole subject of topic that we'll go through and we'll look at, Jeremy. So we will get to that, which is kind of cool. And Eric, so there's no base isotope, and that is correct, that there is no base isotope. There's no standard version of an atom, that is correct. That there is the most prevalent version of an atom. There is the one that we find most often, so that we can say that they have different abundances that we find them in, but we don't think of one as a standard version and the others a variant. We think of them all as just a relationship, as brothers and sisters, and belonging to the same family.
Do they all have the same charge? I suppose. Ooh, same family.
That's an interesting question. Right now, what we're saying is that these are uncharged, Jeremy. So we're not talking about charged particles just yet. That the elements themselves are uncharged as we are talking about them, but that doesn't mean that they can't be charged. And so we will get to ions in a minute. Well, not in a minute, in a while. And when we get to ions, we will find that ions, that each of the isotopes can form the same ions as well. That each of the isotopes can become either negatively charged or positively charged, identical to the entire family. That there's no difference in that. So that's a good question too. Okay. And the last thing, 1932 from James Chadwick. So Chadwick in 1932 found evidence to say that that half the mass of an atom comes from protons. And these protons, these are the positively charged particles that were discovered by Rutherford. That as Rutherford was going through and he was looking at the nucleuses, that these charged particles from Rutherford, those are the charged particles that we'll call protons. And the other half of the mass was from neutral particles. And he dubbed these neutrons. And so that gives us all of the subatomic particles and pieces to actually go through and to start to talk about atomic structure, and leads us into chapter 2.3, into the modern atomic structure, and looking at all of these individual pieces. And this seems like a natural, perfect spot to take a 10-minute break and get everybody a chance to get up and get moving for a few minutes. So I'll let you guys catch a second to catch up on your notes. And then let's take a 10-minute break and let's come back at it's almost 11:20. So we'll come back at like 11:27. And we'll take a 10-minute break. How's that sound?
Good.
Awesome. All right. 10-minute break, people. And we'll come back and we'll put this all together. We'll make a coherent picture out of it.
Jason, I'm curious. The atom bomb is not just the dividing of an atom, right? It's more complex than that.
It is more complex than that. That when we look at an atom bomb, it is the dividing of an atom, but it doesn't divide an atom in half. It's not just taking an atom and blowing it apart. That essentially what winds up happening in an atom bomb, in a nuclear explosion, is that we take an element that undergoes radioactive decay, in this case, uranium or plutonium. And it undergoes radioactive decay when that element gets close enough to itself, when it reaches what's called a critical mass. And that critical mass, the radiation, those elements are undergoing radioactive decay all the time. And so uranium and plutonium, these radioactive isotopes, are giving off neutrons. And every time they give off a neutron, if that neutron that comes off naturally, if that neutron is captured by another element of uranium or plutonium, then it absorbs that neutron and automatically goes into radioactive decay immediately. And it gives off three more neutrons. So now those three neutrons go off, hit other atoms, and those atoms give off three more neutrons. And each time that happens, it propagates exponentially. And it really doesn't start to happen until the elements are pressed close enough. So in an atom bomb, what essentially happens is they have a classical explosive device in a spherical pattern. It takes the plutonium or uranium in a ball and compresses it into that critical mass. The critical mass all of a sudden starts to undergo exponential decay and releases a tremendous amount of energy in a fraction of a second.
Yeah.
And so that uranium and plutonium do divide, the nucleus divides, giving off neutrons, but also a tremendous amount of energy. Mm. And each one of those uranium or plutonium elements falls to a lower element in the periodic table. And so it doesn't disappear and it doesn't just go away. It's still conservation of matter, but it comes with a huge release in energy. Yeah. And that energy is the energy that we think of the nuclear explosion that is actually released. And that energy generates heat and tremendous expansion of gas and also release of radioactive particles. Mm. And so that's what we think of as an atomic bomb. And it's not really that the atom is splitting in half, but it is fractioning in its nucleus and neutrons are coming out of the nucleus and the element is falling back to some other smaller element essentially in the process.
Appreciate that explanation.
Yeah. So that's something that we will go through and we'll look at towards the end of the semester though.
Perfect.
Cool.
All right.
Cool. I'm putting on some music for that break, or at least thinking about figuring out how I can do that. Stop broadcasting for a minute. Do a screen share over here. And hit some music.
Door, I have been nice to you, but I have come to the edge. Look, send me first. remember I kept my eyes shut, because it shaped it like an hourglass. But I think the time's up. So, this is a true story, everybody. Doing the wrong thing sometimes feels much better than doing the right. Listen. I remember, baby, when we were still in school, all the good times that we shared, just breaking all the rules, just trying to find a place with no one around, trying so hard not to make a sound. Well, I don't know, baby, but something's changed now, and all I can say is it ain't the same. Oh, girl, do you remember when we were hiding out, or just a sneaking out for a little making out? Now that you're here to stay, you know the thrill is gone. I like it better when it was wrong. I like it better when it was wrong.
Okay, that looks like that was perfect timing. At the end of the song, I came back in and everything is working out just right. Okay, we are back. At least I'm back. I'm hoping you're back. It is now 11:28 and we're gonna start chapter 2.3 with atomic structure. Chapter 2.3, atomic structure. So we're gonna do this in sequences. In chapter 2.3, we do atomic structure and we look at how the atom is structured internally. I'm gonna turn my camera back on too. And from the atomic structure, we work into this idea of atoms. What actually makes an atom? What makes an element a specific type of element? So we'll get into that. We'll look at isotopes. We'll look at how we know how much an isotope weighs and the masses of these things. And then we start to go into electronic structure, and we look at the structure of the electrons. And from the structure of the electrons, we learn about the structure of the periodic table and how the periodic table is actually constructed and put together and why it has the shape that it has. From electronic structure leads us into ions and the formation of ions of these elements and why they form charged particles and why some of them are positively charged, why some of them are negatively charged. From the electronic structure, we also learn about the valence electrons and how elements come to share electrons and form compounds and why they form compounds. From there, we learn about the shapes of these compounds and the structure of them. And then we start getting into chemical reactions. And so the whole thing builds on itself, all the way starting from what we're doing right now. And that's why it's so critical that we get a really good foundation, is because of how that foundation builds as it goes through. And then we look at also putting math to all of these things and how we quantify all of these things. So that's another component to it as well. But that's the progression that we'll go through. We go through atomic structure, then electronic structure. Then we look at the structure of the periodic table, and then the structure of ionic compounds and molecular compounds, geometry, a little bit of physical geometry of how we put these things together and representations of how we build them and how we demonstrate them or display them, and then into chemical reactions. So that's the whole progression. So one step at a time, atomic structure first. In atomic structure, what we come to know is that if we look at an atom, which is more circular in nature than it is oval, there we go, and that we can say that this is our sort of picture of an atom, that the nucleus inside this atom is very, very tiny. And that the nucleus inside holds all of the mass. So the mass of an atom is in the nucleus. And inside here, we have two different types of particles. We have what are called protons. These are the positively charged ones. And so we give them a symbol. We give them a P with a positive charge on it. And also inside of here are the neutrons. And the neutrons are neutrally charged, so we'll give them a zero symbol. Sometimes I put a line through it just to represent that that's a zero, because the symbol itself of putting a zero up above something looks a little bit odd. And then out here, this is what we call the electron cloud. And the electron cloud is where the volume of the atom is contained, but not the mass. So the electron cloud contains the volume and the nucleus contains the mass. And when we look at an atom overall, that the size of the atom overall is that, there we go, is that from edge to edge, atoms are about 10 to the minus 10 meters. They're very, very tiny. And that the nucleus inside, this nucleus inside is 1 times 10 to the minus 15 meters. So the nucleus is very, very tiny. And to kind of summarize that in terms of, yeah, electrons, you know, we're going to go through this too, but an electron, if we look at the mass of a proton and a neutron, one proton, in terms of mass, if I'm looking at the mass, one proton equals about the mass of one neutron. They're almost equal in mass, but an electron equals 1/2000th the mass of a proton or neutron. So it takes 2,000 electrons to equal the same amount of mass as a proton or a neutron. So the electrons, while they have mass, are very tiny compared to the amount of mass that a proton or a neutron has. That's an important concept, that an electron is 1/2000th a proton. Super lightweight, yeah, super lightweight. Okay, and if we blew, this is the sort of the thing that we say, is that if we blow an atom up to the size of a football field, in terms of its diameter, so we're looking at its diameter, and we're blowing that diameter up to the size of a football field, what we find is that the nucleus would be about the size of a blueberry. So really, when we say that that nucleus is really tiny, if you think about something that is a spherical object with the diameter of a football field, and you picture a blueberry sitting in the middle of that football field, that is the size of the nucleus sitting in there when the football field is the diameter of that entire atom. So the nucleus is just really, really tiny, and yet it contains all of the mass. So that's a critical component there. And we're going to introduce some new units as well. Oh, Finley, I wish he would just calm down. He's agonizing outside. Because atoms are so small. And we have a mass here that, for instance, a carbon atom equals, and let me just write that out because you're not used to seeing C there, but let's say a carbon atom equals 2 × 10⁻²³ grams. We introduce a new unit. So rather than dealing in grams, we're going to deal with what is called an atomic mass unit. The atomic mass unit, which is going to equal an ATM. So that's how we refer to an atomic mass unit, or not an AMU. Let's do it this way. AMU, atomic mass unit. This is defined as 1 AMU. equals 1/12 the mass of a carbon 12 atom. And this carbon 12, this is a specific isotope. We're going to go through isotopes in a little bit, and we'll say exactly how isotopes are designated and what it actually means. But what this means is, so now we have a proton.
Sorry, can I just cut in?
Sure.
1/12 the mass of a carbon negative 12?
Not negative, carbon dash 12.
Oh, that's a dash. Okay, cool.
It's a dash. It's just meaning the isotope. So that's the type of isotope that it is.
Okay, I was confused. Thank you.
And so we have a proton. We have a neutron, we have an electron, and we can have their symbol so that we have a proton with a positive charge, a neutron, it's a lowercase n that we will include the zero on, and an electron that has a negative charge. We have their mass. And their mass is 1.0073 AMU. and 1.0087. So a neutron is a little bit more massive than a proton. And the electron is 0.00055 AMUs. And what I do is I take that, and these are with a lot of sig figs. So we just say that this is approximately 1 AMU for a proton. It's approximately 1 AMU for a neutron, and approximately 1/2000th of an AMU for an electron. So those are the size of those. And gram-wise, we can say that 1 AMU equals 1.6605 times 10 to the minus 24th grams. That's how small an AMU is.
Sir, then what is an AMT?
Oh, no, that's me being a mistake. An AMT is, there's no AMT or ATM. That's the ATM machine that you get money out of. That was me doing a brain fart. Just AMUs. You're on it. Okay. Everybody on board in terms of the table here. So we've got symbols, we've got mass, we've got the approximate mass, and we've got the size of an AMU. We've got a conversion factor that allows us to convert between grams and AMUs. So we've got all of those components. So from here, what we're going to look at is to start to look at isotopes and to start to understand what an isotope actually is and how that works. And to do that, we're going to start off with something called a nuclid symbol. A nuclid symbol is a way of designating an element. So we have the element symbol. And around the element symbol, we think about the element symbol as being sort of like in a box. And over here on the right-hand side, we designate this a location for charge. In the upper left-hand side, we designate this the mass number. And in the lower left-hand side, we designate this the atomic number. Okay, so we need to say sort of what these things are. The mass number this equals the sum of the protons plus the neutrons. So it's taking and adding the protons and neutrons together. It's how many total protons and neutrons there are in the element. And in the atomic number, the atomic number equals just the number of protons. Actually, maybe what we'll say is this is the number of protons. And the charge is the difference between the protons and the neutrons. It's an accounting of, can be thought of, how many protons there are in excess of electrons, or how many electrons there are in excess of protons. So the charge is really the difference. It's not a ratio. A ratio is different. A difference is subtraction. A ratio is division. So it's not a ratio of protons to electrons. It's the difference between protons and electrons.
Okay, thank you.
So in other words, without jumping into mass number and atomic number yet, we can look at charge and we can say charge. Charge equals, if I have six protons, six positive charges, and I have 6 negative charges, then my charge equals 0. If I have 6 positive charges and 7 negative charges, then my charge equals minus 1. If I have 6 positive charges and 5 negative charges, then my charge equals positive 1. So it's the difference between the protons and the electrons, essentially, adding up how many positives and how many negatives and looking at the sum of all the positives and negatives. That's what the charge actually equals. The mass number and the atomic number, we get, in a way, from the periodic table. Let's look at, before we jump into periodic table, let's look at some elements and some isotopes. So we talked about hydrogen. Let's go back to the isotope idea, because I used this symbol before and I didn't explain what the symbol meant because we weren't quite there yet. But now we are. So this is hydrogen. So H equals hydrogen. What these are telling us is they're telling us the number of protons, the number of neutrons, and we could also think about the number of electrons in terms of each one of these isotopes. And we can also then get an approximately atomic mass units, how much each one of these isotopes weigh. So what we're getting out of here is we have the mass number. This is the protons plus the neutrons. And down here, we have just the protons themselves. So each one of these hydrogens has one proton because there is a 1 in the lower left-hand corner. And in fact, it is the number of protons that determines what element it actually is. Any atom that has one proton is a hydrogen. So any element that has one proton is a hydrogen. Any element that has 2 protons is a helium. It is the number of protons that determines what element it is. So all of these are hydrogen because they all have 1 proton. Then we go and we look at the number of neutrons. Well, how do we get the number of neutrons? What we have to do is we have to take the mass number that was given to us, and then we have to subtract the number of protons to figure out how many neutrons there are. So the number of neutrons is 1 subtract 1, 0 neutrons. 2 subtract 1, 1 neutron. 3 subtract 1, 2 neutrons. So the mass number is telling me how many neutrons, sort of indirectly, because I have to use the number of protons to determine how many neutrons there actually are. So in the first type of hydrogen, there aren't any neutrons in its nucleus. In the second isotope, there is 1 neutron. And in the third isotope, there are 2 neutrons. The number of electrons. When we look at the element over here, there is no charge. When there is no charge, that means that the number of positives must equal the number of negatives. Positives equal negatives. And therefore, if there is 1 proton, there must also be 1 electron. And because none of these have charges, they all have 1 electron as well. Now, the atomic mass units, remember that each proton and each neutron weigh about 1 atomic mass unit. So, because the first isotope has 1 proton but no neutrons, it weighs approximately 1 AMU. The second isotope weighs about 2 AMUs because it has a proton and a neutron. The third one has 1 proton and 2 neutrons, so it weighs 3 AMUs. And thus we can see why they call this the mass number up above, the mass number is telling me approximately how many AMUs the element weighs, because that is the sum of all the mass, the protons plus the neutrons. And that's why it's called the mass number. Okay, Eric, I think yes, but I find that it could be helpful to think of it as protons minus electrons. You can think of it as protons minus electrons, but that's going to get you into trouble. You need to think of them as charges, because when we look at positive charges, we have to think that we have an excess of protons. And when we see negative charges, we have to think of having an excess of electrons. And yet some people will see the minus charge and think that that we have less something, not more of something. So the negative charge really means that we have more electrons than the total number of protons. So I try not to think of it quite that way. How wide does this variation occur? That's a great question. Okay, so why do we have these different isotopes? Why is it that there are three different types of isotopes of hydrogen? And the answer is because that's the way Mother Nature made it. There is no easy way to tell you why we get different isotopes. What we find, actually, is that we can make a graph that has, I believe it's the number of protons increasing on the x-axis, and the proton to neutron ratio, or maybe it's the neutron to proton ratio, it's the neutron to proton ratio that is on the y-axis. And what we find is that it starts off at zero and that it goes out in sort of like this increasing sort of fanning out shape. And then there's a little island that's out here. And what we find is that that when we have more protons than neutrons, that these are unstable elements, and that those elements will undergo radioactive decay, and they tend to be elements that are radioactive. And that when I have more neutrons, that these are also unstable. And when they undergo radioactive decay, they give off some part of their nucleus. They give off a proton or something. Neutrons, elements that have too many neutrons can give off a piece of radiation that is a neutron that comes out of their nucleus. And they fall into this area of stable isotopes, stable ratios. And this little island out here is called the island of stability. It's a little area where we find some pretty stable ratios between protons and neutrons as well. And so the answer is that there are just stable combinations of protons and neutrons, but that they fall in a fairly linear, predictable area. And yet there is a range in which they are stable between the neutrons and the protons. And so we find that when they were created, and you have to remember how they were created, they're created in a way in which the sun or suns are doing nuclear fusion, slamming elements into each other in very high force and heat, and they fuse together to make new elements. In the process of that happening, sometimes more or less neutrons get captured together inside the nucleus, which result in variations in isotopes. And so we have various isotopes for different elements that will have different masses. And they just naturally occur in that way. Okay, so I think I hit that question. Question: in water, for example, does it matter which hydrogen isotope makes up the water molecule? Vanessa, that's a great question. Vanessa, have you ever heard of heavy water? There is a term that is used, particularly in nuclear reactors, where they talk about heavy water. And yes, it makes a difference. So when we look at water, water is two hydrogens connected to an oxygen. And these hydrogens, presumably, are the normal hydrogen. What we say normal hydrogen, I want to get away from that. It's the hydrogen which is isotope 1. So this is water with H1. And this water weighs approximately 18 AMU units for the molecule. 16 of those come from the from oxygen. And then 2, 1 each from hydrogen. But we can have what's called heavy water, where we use, I wrote it the wrong way, where we use an isotope of hydrogen, which is the second isotope. And this is water with H2 isotope being used. This weighs 20 AMUs, because now you get 16 from the oxygen, and each of the hydrogens weighs 2 AMUs, so I have 2 more AMUs that are coming to this, so I have 4 from hydrogen, 2 from each. And so we call this heavy water. And that heavy water is used in nuclear reactors as a way to quiet down the nuclear reactors in order to absorb radiation from the nuclear reactors. Hydrogen, the second isotope of hydrogen, is better at absorbing nuclear radiation than is the regular hydrogen. And so it's a way of slowing down nuclear reactions is by using that heavy water. So yes, it actually does make a very big difference which hydrogen isotope is used in terms of how that water is constructed. Now, in any natural, go ahead, question.
Would there ever be variance, like one heavy water, the mass of 2 and the other one with the mass of 1?
Well, actually what we can have, is that we can have a water that is made up of 1 and 2, and this water would be 19 AMUs for the water molecule. And yes, that actually happens. And so in any natural sample of water, as you drink water, the water that you are drinking has some amount of hydrogen 2 in it as well. It is not all hydrogen 1. So it's not as if there's just a natural abundance in which we find these different isotopes in nature. And there's some fantastic stories around the isotopes that we could talk about, which this might actually be a great time to talk about those. Let me get a different screen share and see if I can, I'll do it this way without screen sharing, because that's going to take too much time. And I don't have that much time. So let's do it this way. Let's go back to these isotopes. H1, H2, and H3. By the way, these isotopes have names. Most isotopes are not named, but the family of hydrogen, they named the isotopes. The first isotope of hydrogen is just called hydrogen. The second isotope is called deuterium. And the third isotope is tritium. So do and tri, meaning 2 and 3, that's where the names come from. These are the only isotopes that are named. All of the other element families that have isotopes do not have named isotopes. It is just this family of hydrogen that has the isotopes named. And they come in relative abundances. And I want to go and get their relative abundances for you. So I'm going to pull up an app on my computer that allows me to be able to look at the relative isotopic distribution. And what we find is that 99.9850% of all hydrogens are hydrogen 1. 0.0150% are deuterium, and tritium doesn't really exist naturally occurring. to a degree that we measure within three sig figs. So this is 0.000% to three sig figs. We can probably detect it beyond that. If we went out to 5 or 6 sig figs, we could probably pick up how much of that exists in the environment. But to 3 sig figs, it comes out to be 0%. And the way that these are measured are with an instrument called a mass spectrometer. Spectrometer, there we go. And essentially what they do is they fire these elements through an instrument, and the instrument imparts a charge to the atom, and the atom, I guess this is a good time as any to do that. We take and we fire the particle. And so the hydrogen is going through here. There is a beam that we hit it with that knocks an electron off of it. And it proceeds then as now an ion. And as it proceeds, it goes through a magnetic field. And because it's charged, it will now deviate in the magnetic field. And it comes down and it hits a detector. And the detector has different slots on it, basically like a ruler. And we can tell how massive the particle is by where it hits the detector and how far it deflects. And so we can measure mass very, very accurately. And what we do is we take hydrogen and inject hydrogen into the instrument and measure how many of them are hydrogen one, measure how many of them are hydrogen two, measure how many of them are hydrogen three. And then for each sample, we can then tell the distribution, the percentage of the sample that is made up of each one of those isotopes. And we can measure that very accurately. And what we find is that those isotopes vary from position to position in the Earth's crust. So if we measure samples of hydrogen from California, the isotopic distribution may be different than if we measure them in Nevada, which may be different than if we measure them in China or Europe or Japan or any other place, although they will be very, very similar. And when we take all of those and average them all out, then we get these isotopic distributions that we're reporting here, which is sort of a worldwide average distribution, or we can even think about that as a universe-wide distribution of how we find these isotopes in these natural abundances throughout the universe. Okay, so Marisol, would the protons also peel off towards the negative plate? No, the protons stay with the rest of the atom. So we just basically knock off one electron. And then once we knock off that one electron, the rest of the atom continues on through the magnetic field and will change and deviate from a straight course. And then we can tell how much it weighs. So we're not knocking off protons. We only knock off the outer electrons is the way that mass spectrometer works. And when we go through and we measure these isotopes, we find that different elements have different numbers of isotopes. So numbers of isotopes, if I look at how many isotopes elements have, I don't have numbers memorized. I'm going to look them up for a minute. So hydrogen has 3 isotopes. So we'll do the number of isotopes here. So there's 3 different isotopes of hydrogen. Carbon has 3. Nitrogen has 2. Oxygen has 3. Fluorine in the first row of the periodic table only has 1. meaning that there's only one type of fluorine. It's not like there's one isotope, so there's two types of fluorine. There is one type of fluorine, one isotope, 100%, only F19. But some of them, like tin, tin is the element Sn. So tin, the element Sn, has 10 different isotopes. Iron has 4. I think gold and silver. Gold has 1, silver has 2. Copper has 2. Gold has 1, silver has 2, copper has 2. Anyway, this is not something I want you to memorize. This is something that we look up in a table when we need it or if we're interested. But the point of this was to show you, see, look, I was getting that question even before you said it. I didn't even look up at the screen. No, you don't need to memorize this. This is something that is informational that I wanted to demonstrate that the elements have variable different numbers of isotopes, and it is different from element to element. And we don't predict it, we measure it. So this is something that we go into and we just measure within the environment, and we can tell how many different isotopes there actually are in things. Okay, so for nuclear reactors, do they have a way of making deuterium and heavy water given that it is not naturally abundant? Yes, and tritium, yes. The answers to both of those, yes. We have certain types of nuclear reactions which will produce deuterium. And then we isolate that deuterium and we make heavy water from that deuterium. And tritium, the same thing. We have ways, nuclear reactions that will release tritium, that will make tritium, and then tritium can be used and utilized. And it was, if you remember the old watches that had a glow-in-the-dark dial, and I'm talking about glow-in-the-dark, like phosphorus dial, that that it would glow in the dark, but it wasn't phosphorescence like you normally see. It's not like it absorbs light and then it gives it back off. They just always sort of glowed. That was tritium. And they actually took and used radioactive tritium, and people painted, hand-painted those dials with tritium. And the women that worked in those factories actually developed cancer from working with that tritium paint in order to paint those things on the dials. So yeah, these things that are not abundant in nature, sometimes we have ways of isolating them. Sometimes we have certain types of nuclear reactions which will produce them. So so yes, to both those questions, which are fascinating questions. Okay, another sort of idea that I mentioned, which is a little nice maybe thing to end on here before going too far with these, because the next part that I get into gets really mathematically complicated and I don't have enough time to do it, so I don't want to do it today, so I'm going to tell a story instead. Lead. When we look at lead, Pb, one of the things that we use lead for is to make bullets, and that bullets are made out of lead. And depending upon the lead that is used, where it is quarried from, where it is obtained within the Earth's crust, that lead has a specific isotopic makeup. And so for lead, what we find, where is Pb? There it is. There are 4 different isotopes of lead. There is 204. There is 206. There's 207, and there's 208. And they come in relative isotopic distributions of about 1.40%, 24.1%, 22.1%, and 52.4%. But these percentages vary depending on location and factory and even the specific lot of bullets. when a hunter goes out and uses bullets and they shoot and hunt animals, oftentimes the animal will get struck by the bullet and yet still be able to run for a far distance before the animal dies. I'm thinking like deer and things. And oftentimes the hunter doesn't want to go and track down that animal because it's just traveled too far because of a poor shot before the animal dies. So that animal dies in nature. And then there are certain types of vultures, like California condors, which will go find that dead animal and ingest that dead animal and eat that dead animal. That's the nature of what condors do. However, the condors go for the soft, squishy spots when they start eating an animal. So they look for the bullet wounds and they eat from the bullet wound into the animal, ingesting parts of the bullet. The lead that the condor ingests causes the birds to die from lead poisoning. And so for the longest time, California condors have been killed by lead bullets from hunters in California, and the California condors are on the verge of extinction because of hunting in California and the use of lead bullets. But the hunters within California claim that you can't prove that that's true. You cannot prove that a bird died because it ate a bullet. And because you're not finding bullet fragments inside the stomach of the bird, these are small particles of lead that they have ingested. And so the hunter's argument has always been that you can't prove that the bird died from ingesting a lead bullet versus just ingesting it in the natural environment. And maybe that bird got it from someplace else in the natural environment. And so that is how the bird died. Well, scientists took that as a challenge and they said, well, no, we actually can prove that. So what the scientists did is they went out and they collected dead condors and they analyzed their feathers. They took clippings of the feathers and they injected those feathers into mass spectrometers and they measured the lead isotopes in the feathers. And then they took birds that were alive and that were fine and healthy and they measured the lead in their feathers. And what they could do is they could detect a difference in the isotopic distribution of the actual lead in the feathers. And then they went out and they collected all the different carcasses that they could find in the area. And they took those carcasses and they measured the lead inside the animal that had died. They took fragments of the bullet and they measured the isotopic distribution of the lead bullet. And they were able to get a specific match with birds that had died in the area and the lead in their feathers and the isotopes of the lead in the bullet. And they were able to show that they were a perfect match. Not only that, but they could tell exactly what factory manufactured that bullet and when that bullet was produced by the isotopic distribution in the bullet itself. And they were able to show conclusively that the birds were eating the carcasses, ingesting the lead, and it was the lead that was killing the bird, and that lead was coming from the bullets, and there was a perfect match. So that gave scientists the power to actually go in and to change the laws within California and to make it illegal to use lead bullets for hunting in certain areas of California in order to protect the California condors. And so this whole idea of measuring isotopes and looking at isotopes is really this cool idea that it allows us to be able to look at an area from where material was taken. And we can actually drill down and tell the area that a material was taken from or mined from or produced from by measuring the isotopic distribution of that element in that sample. And so from there, what we're going to do is we're going to take these and we're going to learn how do we figure out if each one of these lead atoms weighs a different amounts of AMUs. For instance, we take lead and we look at each one of these and we say, all right, lead that is lead 204, weighs about 204 AMUs. And lead that is 206, weighs 206 AMUs. And lead 207 weighs 207 AMUs. And lead that is 208 weighs 208 AMUs. What does an average lead atom weigh?
Would it be the average of the isotopes?
It is, but it's the weighted average of the isotopes. It's not just the average of the isotope itself. It is the relative abundance times the mass of the isotope and then added together. So it is what is called a weighted average. And when you look at the periodic table and you see the mass that is at the bottom of the periodic table, and we see that lead and the symbol in the periodic table has a 207.2. This is the average mass, the average AMUs for a lead. And we're going to learn how to calculate that and do that specifically. And so that's where we go from this story, is we go through looking at how do we calculate the average mass of an element given all of its isotopes, and then what does that average actually mean, and how can we use it? And that's where we go tomorrow. So that's where I want to go. And so let's open it up for questions. I'm sure after me telling some stories, you guys probably have some questions. And we'll open it up for a few questions, and then we'll call it good for lecture today. So what have you guys got? Throw them at me. Or maybe you don't have anything. Maybe you were just enamored with the story and you're done and we're good. And that's okay too. Anything come up for anybody?
Office hours today, right?
Yes. Office hours are Monday through Thursday from 3:30 to 5:15. So Monday through Thursday, okay. 3:30 to 5:15. And you can always find me there. Why is there no lead 205? I was wondering who was going to ask that, when that was going to come up. Good eyes, Marisol. I'm always interested to see who's paying attention and who's on it. There's no lead 205 because naturally occurring, that ratio just doesn't tend to form. All of these things, these isotopes, you have to remember, are formed in nature through the action of fusion within the sun. And actually, that's not entirely true. Some of them are formed in other ways, like carbon-14. Carbon-14 is produced in the atmosphere when CO2 goes into the atmosphere and we get radiation from the sun. Carbon-14 is formed through absorption of radiation from the sun in the atmosphere. So some of these isotopes do form outside of nuclear fusion. And Eric, that's another good question. Can 205 be created by man? I don't know the answer to that question. I would guess that the answer to that question is probably yes, but I have not researched it. And it doesn't show up on the table of isotopes that I've got. So I'm assuming that it can be created by man in a cyclotron type of device. But to my knowledge, it is not naturally occurring. So that's the answer to that question as well. So many of these isotopes, you'll find they don't always go sequentially. Sometimes you'll find them with one or two missing because that isotope just doesn't naturally occur. And yeah, in a particle accelerator. Yes, correct. Let's see if there's anything else. I don't know. Kerrigan, you got another question?
No, not now.
Okay. I just saw your mic was queuing up. I saw your screen went yellow for a second, meant that you were queuing up something. So I was sensing a question developing. But yeah, anyway, that's all I've got for today. And let's adjourn here and we'll pick it up with the afternoon lab. And I'll have more information and more stuff for the afternoon lab. Okay? Sound good? All right, I'll hang on the line while you guys log off. If anybody has any questions they want to deal with individually, I'll be here for a few minutes. And I'll see you guys in the afternoon lab.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, thank you, guys. Thanks for being here, being a part of it.
So I lied. I do have a question.
Ah, see, I knew it.
Yeah. So just to touch base on the lab situation that I have going on.
Sure.
So since I can't get into the lab, what should I do?
Kerrigan, I am not sensing I don't have any sense of urgency here. The lab, you have been attending and you have been paying attention, and I have that one assignment that is up, and the assignment has no termination date. Oh. So hang tight, keep going to lab, keep participating in person, and as soon as you can log in and get into Canvas, then go in and complete that lab assignment that I put up, and that's all you got to do.
Okay, cool. And I can still access all the lab content?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. You're not cut out of anything because you can't get into Canvas right now. You're fine. Oh,
what a relief. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Jason, I was wondering if you could scroll up to where you started writing the section 2.3.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
Right there. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, anybody else have any other questions? All right, if there's no more questions, I propose that we adjourn it here, and I'm gonna go get some lunch before the afternoon lab starts. Okay, I'll see you guys in the afternoon lab. You guys take care.